What's going on, everyone? Welcome back to another intriguing podcast episode with me, Ramblings of a Sikh. Today, we're joined by Huda McBill, a whistleblower and former intelligence officer in CSIS, Canada's primary national intelligence service. From her roots in Ethiopia to breaking barriers in intelligence, Huda unveiled the crucial impact of diversity in national security. Discover how she navigated the post-9/11 shift in counterterrorism and the complex web of global threats. Get ready for a captivating journey with Huda as she reveals groundbreaking insights from the inside of the intelligence world. Obviously, I think we all want to ask, what inspired you to join the Secret Service in Canada?
I applied to CSIS in year 2000, so before September 11. I was taking a course in law in national security. And it was my professor that approached me and said, Huda, you speak so many languages. I speak four languages, so Arabic, Harari, French, and English. And so he thought that would be an asset to the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, and he encouraged me to apply. So that's kind of how my interest in joining. And at the time, there wasn't a lot of information about CSIS within public record. They didn't have a website. So I filled my application and sent it in and was glad to hear back from them. And at the time, to increase my chances to get in, I was taking a Russian language, introductory Russian language program. And my understanding of that world of espionage was that the threats were coming from Russia, China. So espionage and counterterrorism was, was there always, but it wasn't what the organization did predominantly. It wasn't the priority. And so I got into CSIS shortly after September 11 because that recruitment process is very long. It's lengthy. They do a lot of background checks on you. There's levels of interviews that's conducted, as well as a psychological assessment, a polygraph exam. So after all of that, I received my welcome aboard letter August 2001. And had no idea just how useful I would be to the organization and to fight terrorism.
Wow. Okay. There are so many questions off the back of that I want to kind of dive into. Obviously, yeah. I think the big one that's sticking out, and everyone listening is probably wondering, how did 9/11 change everything?
Yeah. So I joined at a time when, right after September 11, where, Anti-Terrorism Act was coming to be. And the organization, I saw that shift from counter-espionage to counterterrorism priority, becoming a priority, many of our resources shifting to that threat, and our partners within, partners, Canadian partners. So, our RCMP, CBSA, this is border security. All of these agencies really, they're gaining legislative powers to fight terrorism and relied heavily on the security service to be in the lead of that. And so I was part of that community where we were trying to ensure that we, we have a grip on what's happening in the country in terms of counterterrorism. It's become a priority because it's threat to life. So unlike, some other espionage cases, corporate espionage and whatnot, it's been a priority for the last 20 years, especially as there's been, we had the Iraq war afterwards, our military in Afghanistan. And so it's been, there's been a concentration, and that shift wasn't just in Canada, that shift was in the UK as well. So MI5 went through similar change as CSIS, prioritizing counterterrorism, and working with our partners. So we work very closely with the Americans and the British, within the Five Eye intelligence community. The Australians and New Zealand and Canada are part of it. There's been a change, but I would say that's more recently. And I would say it was shortly before COVID where the priority has shifted again to counter espionage. And that's predominantly coming from China. The war in the Ukraine has put Russia back on, the priority list of things that the organization's looking at. There's a variety of threats now. They're way more complex, and it is not focused on counterterrorism. Yes, there is that angle. I think that's gonna always be there. But the priority right now is that, you know, that rise of China and as well as cybersecurity. And when it's combined with critical infrastructure, corporate espionage, and it's being used as warfare. So aggressive sort of cybersecurity threats to collect, but also to attack government and institutions in different countries. So definitely a shift, seeing that shift through as well has been really interesting for me.
What were then some of the operations, and I don't know how much you can talk about or what you can share, but like, what were some of the operations that you were involved or others were involved in? And like, in terms of giving an idea of what does counter-espionage entail? And I guess at the same time, surely these institutions are also involved in their own espionage in other countries, like equally just as much as the MI5 and FBI and CSIS may be looking for Russian or Chinese spies. Surely it's the same thing in those countries, that they're looking for spies from the West, from whichever nation that might be. As you said, there's obviously all sorts of different facets that CSIS are involved in. But like, in practical terms, what does that entail? Like, what operations are involved? Like, what are you actually doing day to day?
Yeah, so my day-to-day operation, like at CSIS, you work as an analyst. So you work at headquarters in Ottawa, and you look at, we have regional offices, about 8 of them across the country. So there is information that's incoming, and what you do is analyze that information, write memos to senior management in terms of advice on what's happening and how we will be tackling it, what kind of recommendations we're providing to the regions. Also at headquarters as an analyst, you're providing information and sharing information with allied countries. Sometimes you might be interacting with countries that are outside of that alliance as well. So meetings, memos, analysis, a lot of it is really centered around those kind of activities in headquarters. Then after 3 years, 2 to 3 years, you go to a regional office. So in my case, I was in the Toronto office, which is our largest regional office, and you work as an investigator. So you go out, now you're a collector of information. So you're conducting interviews, whether it's at airports, whether it's at different parts, helping the border security folks, immigration interviews, because CSIS does security screening recommendations to our immigration department, as well as running human sources, developing human sources that can assist you in the investigations that you're working on. And as an intelligence officer, the way I see it, you're managing an operation. And so you're using all these different tools to conduct your operation. You are, if you need to physical surveillance or technical surveillance, you're requesting this information, you're briefing your security, physical security folks. If there's material that needs to be interpreted from a foreign language, you're sending that to individuals that can do that. And then taking all that information, making recommendations to your superiors in terms of, how you want to run the operation, who would be a good human source that could provide further information so that your operation is progressing in the way that it should. So that's counterterrorism. In terms of counterintelligence, and I've also worked on the China and Russia desk, you're looking for spies. So it's a really different kind of game altogether. You're looking at individuals that may be that are in the country, that are conducting spying activity, whether it's, you know, through government or even at the corporate level. And those investigations tend to be very sensitive because there's that diplomatic angle to it. You know, there's a lot of consulting with our Foreign Affairs Department, as well as other government departments when it comes to those kind of threats. There's also, CSIS also does a counter-proliferation program as well. And that's looking at countries like Iran and others, North Korea, that may be developing nuclear weapons and ensuring that they're not, you know, bringing people into the country and, you know, through universities or other research centers and gaining knowledge that has been developed here in Canada to further their programs. And also, you know, learning and knowing, collecting information around the world in terms of, you know, how do these agencies, whether it's, you know, Chinese spies or Russian spies or Iranian counterproliferation threats, or counterterrorism. So how are other countries tackling this threat? And what can we do better here at home? And that exchange of information is vital in that regard.
Obviously, with you joining CSIS just kind of like a month after, or just around 9/11, like how did that impact you working in the institution that is CSIS?
Yeah, I write quite a bit about this in my book. Sometimes unnerving, sometimes, you know, glad to be an insider so that I can provide the expertise that I have that I saw lacking. So I was the first Arabic speaker within our counterterrorism program. And, you know, that there was definitely a knowledge gap. And, you know, at the time you could say, okay, it's racism, but here I am and I have a choice whether to leave or to continue to work in this organization now and ensure that kind of bias doesn't get into the kind of work that they're doing. And that's really important. So some of the things I did was, you know, have a kind of a lunchtime program where I was teaching about Islam and Arabic history, cultures. And so, you know, that's what I did. And at times, you know, because of where I come from, because of my knowledge in terms of religion and culture and so on, my interpretation of operations was different than others. I have to say, like, it was very difficult, especially the first 2 years after 9/11, to really challenge and question the way in which my managers and others saw things and or interpreted things. And so I did when I could. And I think it's made a difference. At the same time, after 2.5 years, I found myself the target within CSIS, so kind of treated as an outsider. And I think there was a real effort to actually push me out of the organization. I sometimes wonder why necessarily, but I did see it in the US and other places where there was this, you know, initially there was this understanding, if we bring in more people with knowledge in terms of that region of the world, then that augments our operations. But within 2 to 3 years, the war on terrorism took a different direction. There was a lot of abuse in terms of human rights. There was a lot of, you know, that renditions and the war in Iraq and, and looking at it from a counterterrorism operation kind of angle, which wasn't necessarily there. It wasn't the reason why the Americans went in. So I think that there was this understanding that someone like me would question and would be very, upset by all of this. And so there was this lack of trust. And I think that's the reason that the organization was trying to push me out. I had by the time learned a lot about the organizations, and you know, I had a really strong commitment to public safety, and I felt that they needed me, and I felt like my country needed me, and I felt that being there was much better than not being there, because I knew that there wasn't going to be a lot of people like me coming into the organization. So in terms of, you know, the kind of scrutiny that was placed on Muslim individuals that would be applying for these jobs, many were not getting it. And so I felt really a great responsibility to stay the course and put up with a lot of misogyny, racism. and it's a big part of my book, you know, it's a big part. And some publishers wanted more of the operational stuff. They wanted me to change the book. And I decided to go with academic publishing because I wanted it to be real. And I didn't want to change anything from the way that I wrote the book. And so you'll see in the book that I'm an insider, outsider, you know, that I bring value because of those identities that I hold. But at the same time, I'm under scrutiny and, you know, by the organization for the same reason. So it's been, you know, good and bad in many ways. Like, I enjoyed kind of the work itself. I think the mandate is important. I had some really good colleagues. I had opportunities to do things that many did not as a result of the language and the and what I brought to the table. One of them includes, and I begin with this in my book, is working in London. So I was asked to participate in the investigations into 7/7 and 21/7. I worked at MI5 headquarters within their counterterrorism, East Africa, Gulf region. So that was the desk that I was on, and was able to contribute in that way, represent CSIS, represent my country, and do some really good work in ensuring that, you know, for public safety.
We've spoken a number of times, and you've touched upon it as well, about how you come from a rich background. Like, do you mind just expanding a little bit on kind of the heritage and the history that you hold and kind of the different identities?
Yeah, certainly. So I was born in Ethiopia. My mom is Ethiopian. She's from Harar. And that's the language that I speak, Harari. My father's from Yemen. And we had to leave Ethiopia due to the civil war there. We ended up in Djibouti for a couple of weeks where we were trying to decide whether we should go back to Yemen or go to another country. And Egypt won. So Egypt at the time was, you know, the center kind of knowledge. Many people within the Arab world, you know, including Yasser Arafat, including Saddam Hussein and others, you know, and their kids, everybody sent their children. And it was a hub for education. And so my father decided that we were going to move to Egypt. So I lived in Cairo for 8 years, and that was an incredibly rich experience. I loved it. And then we decided to move to Canada. And that's because, you know, in Egypt, you could be Arab, which I am. I held a Yemeni passport. You could be Muslim, but there's no path to citizenship. And you can never call it your country, right? You have to, your father, at the time, it wasn't even your mother. It had to be, your father had to be Egyptian. And so because my father's Yemeni, there was no way. And as my brothers were, you know, about to graduate from high school, we understood that it would be very difficult for them to get jobs. As you know, Egypt is an, you know, really populated country, Egyptians first. And so it wasn't a place where we could settle and call home. And my father understood that. And then, so we moved to Canada and I moved to, Montreal, Quebec. And it's an area of Canada where we speak French. And so I was in French schools for 3 years. Then we moved to Ottawa, which is the capital. And so, you know, that's how I acquired all these languages, living, you know, in being born in Ethiopia, living in Egypt, and going through schooling in Arabic for 8 years, and then French in Montreal, and then here in Canada. And of course, I think it helped that I was in the capital. So, you know, this is a government town. And when I graduated, it just felt like that's the kind of work that I would do, that I should be looking for work in the government. So that's the background and the knowledge and the experience that was so unique to CSIS because they just didn't have it. And you know, in Canada, as well as the UK, the US, there's been efforts from long ago to exclude racialized people from these jobs. So there's a book by John Kerry. It's called The Enigma. And the book talks about from the 1950s to 1980, so not too long ago, that there was a color bar for individuals to join, particularly the UK GCHQ, which is equivalent to NSA, so everyone knows the national security. Yeah, so he looked at that organization, but I think it applies across, and it also applies to Canada and the UK. And so structurally, these organizations are predominantly white, they're predominantly male. Even within CSIS, it was, you know, the first female intelligence officer was in 1984. And so when I walked through the door at CSIS, it was really a historic thing. I didn't recognize it to be that way. I didn't recognize it to be that way. But so there were, you know, women at middle management, and there was, you know, a couple of Black women that joined the organization before me. So I think I was third or fourth. And no Arab women, so very few racialized people, very few. And it really took, an act by Parliament to make those changes. So it didn't happen because these organizations suddenly wanted to become diverse. It was because we had the Employment Equity Act. The act itself required that these government institutions, reflect society. And then there was going to be audits. And the first audit was going to happen around year 2000, which is the time where myself and others were, you know, getting into the organization.
If there were, like, how would you, or how did you deal with, say, when there were operations or there were things happening in, say, countries that you have an affinity to, or your family's from, or your friends are from, or I don't know, like, as in, no one is immune from, like, the context that we live in. Like, as in, how do you deal with, or was it ever an issue that, I don't know, CSIS are going to this particular country to do X, Y, and Z, or you're aware that some other agency is doing something here? Like, as in, you spoke about, I guess, some of the human rights abuses that happened in Iraq and things like that. Like how do you kind of, I guess, square that circle in terms of, like, surely there's some human reaction to it, but equally there's not necessarily something you can direct, like, you can't directly influence that either. But how do you, I guess, understand that, considering the numerous identities that you hold and kind of, I guess, the affinity you may have to certain regions?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Really good question. And, you know, there was a lot that I held inside. Couldn't really share and speak about it to my colleagues, my managers. And it ate at me. But at the same time, these institutions aren't kind to individuals seeking support, right? The moment that you do, you're stuck in a basement, not doing any kind of meaningful work. A real stigma. There's a real stigma in terms of seeking that kind of support. But also, you know, it's really difficult to get that kind of supporting. You know, can you imagine going to a psychologist and being, I work for this agency and I'm really having, you know, ethical, moral issues that I don't know how to deal with. And so you really can't. And you can't speak to your friends. You can't speak to your parents. Nobody should know or you know, nobody knows what goes on in the building once you walk in, even those that know that I'm working at the security agency. And so, you know, I had to keep a lot and try to find other outlets, sports, you know, doing a few things that you enjoy. And yes, those kind of situations came up a lot for me. And I, you know, things that I could change, I would try, such as, you know, when I went through what we call our internal security, where, you know, there was like a trust issue with the organization. You know, I sent complaints that went through various levels to really fight back this kind of treatment and racism. And I know that it changed policies, practices for others that were coming through. So I was asked a lot about my religiosity, this kind of stuff. And I made an effort to say, you know, the two don't link. Just, you know, because you're a practicing Muslim does not mean that you support terrorism in any way, shape or form. And so, you know, those are the kind of changes I could do on the inside to make it a little bit better for people like me that are joining in. And provide support to new people that are coming in terms of navigating the workplace culture. You know, so those are the kind of things that brought me some satisfaction of the fact of being there, but definitely seeing abuses, human rights abuses, seeing our allies, especially the United States, being involved in this kind of activity was really, really difficult. We have a very, very strong relationship with the CIA, with the FBI. We work very closely with them. And a lot of times that's such an important strategic relationship. You know, we share the biggest border. And Canada doesn't invest as much as it should on its security and intelligence as well as military. And so the Americans, you know, are present everywhere. They're really our eyes and ears. We interpret the world through them. And at the same time, because of those reasons, you know, the culture within CSIS was that we don't criticize the U.S. Or anything they do or the decisions that they make. And they found that really difficult. I found that really difficult. Understanding that relationship, but also understanding that they're not doing things in a way that is respectful to human rights and so on. So these kind of politics were difficult to handle. I was glad that Canada did not go to war in Iraq. And I looked at our mandate being threats within Canada. And so I felt, okay, you know, I'm comfortable staying here and I'm comfortable doing this work. I believe in the mandate and Canada has taken some decisions that I supported and felt were good. You know, that's as much as I can say. You know, a lot of times there are specific examples, but because, you know, having worked in a top secret environment, you can't you can't really share operational details or, you know, so that's why I'm not so specific.
No, that's absolutely fine. I completely appreciate that. You obviously spoke about America and how that influences Canadian intelligence. Like, and your book dives into this a little bit further in terms of how international politics impacts espionage. Like, how else does, or what other ways, whilst you were working there, did events that were happening around the globe impact directly the work that you were doing?
Yeah, it definitely did. The director of MI5 spoke about, you know, the war in Iraq, how it radicalized so many people. I think here as well as in the UK and other parts, the way in which the war on terrorism itself was being taken as a pretext for other kind of imperial goals. So those kind of politics play into the way in which threats materialize. And you see that that it picks up when these kind of events occur. So, you know, once we went into Afghanistan, there was a lot of discontent in terms of the activities that were being conducted there, as well as Iraq, and then there was, you know, a time where the focus was on in Gulf countries, in Yemen, and so these kind of events do impact operations because there's always a link, you know, there's always a link in terms of foreign policy, American foreign policy, as well as Canadian and UK foreign policy, to the way in which others interpret the world. And so you see kind of an uptick when those kind of events occur. And then now you're seeing it with the rise of China. So the US, China's been, since COVID, has been flexing kind of its muscles in, you know, the maritime around them, on its borders. And we're seeing now that the U.S. is looking at them from that angle, prioritizing kind of the threat coming from China. And it's impacting us here in Canada. So one of the biggest, our director came out and spoke about interference by China, as well as Russia and other players, Iran. So political interference has become a real concern now. And it's because of these shifting geopolitics that are occurring. And they're so complex and difficult. You know, we have the US, which is our first trading partner, and then China is the second. And so it places us in a really, it's interesting times because there's no argument that there's a very important trade relationship with China, and so how do you tackle that, those kind of threats, foreign interference? How do you manage to make sure the relationship is not impacted? There was an incident here in Canada where somebody was killed, a Sikh man was killed in Vancouver, and it was determined, the Prime Minister came at the House of Commons and said that it was RAW, which is Indian intelligence, that conducted this operation. Again, another incident of foreign interference with the direct outcomes here in Canada for us. There's, you know, that relationship is sour now. that world of espionage, counterterrorism, political interference, often so much other complexities in terms of, you know, our partnership with China, India, and other on other angles. So this kind of activity is happening. How do you manage it? And send that message that, you know, countries should not be conducting those kind of activities in our country.
Everyone listening to this, is ears have probably pricked up with you mentioning the assassination of the Sikh man in Canada. Now, I don't know how much you would be aware or how much you can share, but like, what is, like, so my question, first of all, is surely it's a failure of Canadian intelligence for Indian intelligence to be able to actually successfully operate some, like, actually, what's the word, complete such an operation in Canada in the first place. But then secondly, how would Canadian intelligence have reacted to then have finding out that, or how have they reacted to then finding out that actually it was raw and it was a foreign interference and kind of the repercussions of that?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's, it was unprecedented. It had not happened before. And I think that's the reason why organizations like CSIS would not have assumed that India would be so daring to come into Canada and kill someone. And, you know, it, so it took us by surprise. And it was also American information that provided that kind of confirmation that it is the Indian intelligence that was involved in this. So the reaction to it from these organizations, and, you know, I've been out of CSIS since 2017, so I'm guessing as much as any member of your audience would be guessing, but it would sour the relationship, not just between the two countries, but between the two agencies. And we've had really good level of cooperation between RAW and CSIS. So there would be that it would be impacted, that relationship would be impacted. You know, there will be then a thorough investigation. And my understanding is that there is an RCMP investigation. So the RCMP would be equivalent to the FBI in our, or Metropolitan Police in your, on your side of things. So there would be an investigation, and you know, those findings have not come out yet. So I'd be looking forward to see how the organization is managing and ensuring them that this kind of activity doesn't happen again, and to reassure the public, to reassure the communities that that, you know, to reassure it doesn't happen again. So is it an intelligence failure? I think it's unfortunate. I think sometimes you assume that countries like that would respect you know, the sovereignty of Canada in this, and it's really unfortunate. And we're seeing players like that nowadays, right? As populism has become a real concern around the world, and countries, you know, the Russians did it in the UK, you know, and the UK also has a very, very strong intelligence community. And when it happened, it was, you know, just like in Canada, a surprise. And but I find that the UK is more transparent. And so, you know, they provided all the evidence and the images of the individuals doing this kind of activity, you know, the targeting a former intelligence officer that was living in the UK. And so that's the kind of transparency I hope to see from the investigations that CSIS and the RCMP will be conducting into this, so that, you know, that information is shared. And more now within the security and intelligence world, there is a real need to share and to ensure that the public is aware of these kind of situations and is able to report and look out, because the organizations is, you know, limited in terms of resources. It can't be everywhere. The threats are getting complex. We're looking at, you know, so much more nowadays. And so, you know, there is a there's a real need to share. So I hope that kind of information does come out in the future.
then obviously rewinding to 2017, you mentioned that you left at that point. Now, I'm assuming this ties into the point that you decided to kind of, the turning point, I guess, in your story, where you decided to kind of whistleblow what was occurring. Now, what was the process that led up to that? And also, like, how did you process the kind of repercussions of what you would do? Because surely you were aware that there would be X or Y repercussion and kind of had, like, how that would have impacted you personally and professionally. So how did that all kind of come to be and how did that pan out?
Yeah, I never imagined I would go public with having worked in at TSIS. And, you know, I lived about 16 years not telling anybody outside of my family and really close friends. Didn't tell them where I worked, what I was in terms of my career. So it went from being private to being public. But before that, in 2017, it was myself, the first Black woman, a gay man whose partner is Muslim, and two Muslim officers. And all of us had worked for 16 plus years in the organization. And all of us felt that there was that ceiling glass. There was, you know, we had dealt with so much of the discrimination and the harassment and a real culture of reprisal that's so present in the organization. And, you know, enough was enough. And so once we realized that you can't make a change within the organization, there's a limit to that. It's important, but there is a limit to that. We got together and sued the organization through the Canadian Human Rights Commission, as well as the civil court route. What the organization did, the response was to hire a third-party investigative firm, and they conducted a climate assessment of the Toronto office. The climate assessment's results corroborated everything that we were saying in terms of lack of trust in our management, the culture of reprisal, the discrimination, the lack of diversity, misogyny within the workplace. In the report, they described TSIS as a place that wasn't like touched by modernity. and it's because it's been such a closed off place, you know, it hasn't been held to account the way other departments have been. And so that was, you know, that affirmed everything that we were alleging in our complaints. And we came to a settlement with CSIS. And that's how I left the organization. That's when I decided to write the book. I had requested access to information. So I had all my files kind of the communication that was about me, through our internal security with management. I had like a pile of notes, and communication that was going on, as well as my account of what occurred. Right. And I felt that all of that would, make for a great book. I wanted to tell my story. I knew there is a woman with a hijab who was the first Arab woman in the military. And I've always been curious about her story. I know the culture is very it's similar in the military. She passed away that year, actually, in 2000 and is it late 16 or 17? So around that time. And I wondered, I remember sitting at my desk wondering, what did she go through? What was it like for her? And so I decided I was going to write it. I think that's a way to ensure that what happened to me doesn't happen to others. It's in my voice. It's my lived experience, and I own it. And I made sure that I write it in a way that is respectful to my obligations under the Security of Information Act. So I'm not violating, you know, I'm not talking about thesis methods or sources or operational stuff. I used a lot of what was in the public realm. So cases that went before the court where there's a lot of detail already in the public realm. So I felt that it was important to write it, to share, to document, to start that conversation and really make it about equity and diversity within national security. And as I was writing it, I was looking at the US, I was looking at the UK, and I found that they had similar issues, similar concerns, and that this was something that would be of value, not just in Canada, but in other countries as well. And I'm, you know, really pleased right now. Like it's, the book has made it to the Spy Museum in Washington. There's a former executive of the CIA that has read it and written a review of the book, and it's on the CIA's website. So it's, it's gaining a lot of attention. It's a unique and really different story. I just felt it needed to be told.
My last question then is, how do you envision your legacy and what message do you hope readers will take away from the book?
One of the reasons, you know, I think was really important to write the book is to speak to not just the discrimination, but the contribution. And the fact that I contributed to operations in the UK as well as in the US and some around the world, I think is what I want to leave behind. The fact that, you know, I've made that contribution, and you know, yet all of the other negative things were happening and I stayed strong. It's a story of resilience and courage. And those are the kind of stories that I think young racialized people need to know. I also think that people aren't joining these organizations because they're not seeing themselves within these organizations. And so seeing me and understanding that, yes, you know, it's a difficult journey, but it's the career. And I always say this, the career itself is very interesting. And so, you know, I'm always encouraging people to join. I didn't do all of this and write about it so that people stay away. I want these organizations to change. And that's the only way in which they will change. In the hopes that if people, racialized people, more women, people living with disabilities, you know, all these equity seeking groups, have a different interpretation of the world. So a feminist foreign policy, a more, you know, less bias within these organizations. That's what I want to see. And the only way to do this is to diversify the workforce. You know, not, they make, these organizations make important decisions about who gets into this country, you know, in terms of immigration policy, foreign policy, the way we see threats. So, you know, is the priority today Islamic extremism or violent far-right extremism? And how do we tackle it, right? So that's not going to change unless the work force is different than what it is today. And I think that that's one way where we miss threats. So nobody predicted January 6th was going to happen, right? We also here had the truck convoy movement that kind of paralyzed our downtown. So Parliament, our Privy Council office, our Prime Minister's office, you know, for 6 weeks or so, where it was really difficult for the country and a real embarrassment for Canada. So I think that the lack of diversity in itself is a security threat. You can't do security and intelligence work unless you have a diverse workforce so that you are tackling threats and prioritizing threats the right way, that you don't have bias, whether it's conscious or unconscious. And so that's a legacy I want to leave behind, that, you know, here I was living by that example, you know, doing the work, staying the course, contributing, and trying to make the place a little bit better for, you know, I'm under no illusion that I'm going to change an organization in 16 years and with what I did. It's probably just a scratch, you know, but it's an important one. And so that kind of, that's what I leave behind. And I continue to do this work right now, but as an outsider. So I do the work by speaking at universities, speaking in shows like you. I was in University of Victoria just last week, at McGill the week before. And I see a lot of hope in young people that are looking to join these organizations. I think that our educational system, public awareness, especially after George Floyd, those things I think really, really made a huge difference. And I think that that change is coming. It's slow, but it's coming as the organization itself evolves. So hopefully, you know, that those messages resonate and we're able to diversify the field itself.
And that's the end of another intriguing podcast episode. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed creating this podcast. If you're passionate about the work I'm doing and want to support it, consider becoming a paid YouTube member to unlock some cool features or join our Patreon community. You can find the link in the description below. Thanks again for tuning in, and I'll hopefully see you in the next video. Bye!